Moncrief on News Talk.
It is time for parenting. Joanna Fortune joins us once again. Good afternoon, Joanna.
Good afternoon, Sean.
First question is this. Two girls, both 11, who are friends on the road and also in the school in fifth class. Something has happened and now they're no longer pals. They won't walk to school together and won't speak. My daughter won't tell me what happened between them or talk about it, as she doesn't want to get anyone into trouble, but seems very upset by it all. Do I, as her mother, get involved? Do I go ask my neighbour, the other mam, to get involved? Or do I let them figure it out? They're very different in every way, but I would hate to see the friendship run its course because they can't navigate whatever happened. I really have no clue what it was, or was one of the girls more at fault than another?
Ooh, and do you know that last line, Sean? I'm just thinking, does it matter? You know, does it matter if one was at fault more than the other? I suppose there's two ways of looking at this. I think as parents, it's really understandable that we want to know everything that's going on in our kids' lives, you know, as if we can somehow make meaning out of it. But the truth is, in certain situations, especially with peer relationships, we may not need to know the nitty-gritty or the detail of what's happened, but we can still meet our children in the upset they're experiencing and support them in navigating those feelings. And maybe in this instance, navigating this little girl, navigating her way out of the friendship, if that's what is needed. Because there's something here that they're very different in every way, but I would hate to see the friendship run its course. And I'm just thinking, Sean, like, they're 11, they're in fifth class. Perhaps these differences have actually caught up on them in this preteen stage of development. We tend to see a lot of peers shift and change around this stage of development. You know, some of them are getting, you know, that very pseudo maturity and ready for secondary school. And some of them are just still exactly where you, a 11-year-old would be. So I'd be thinking it may be that they're, the differences that this parent has identified, maybe they're just too different now and the friendship has in fact run its course. There's something else in here that's like, I don't want to get anyone in trouble, that infers something happened. You know, when a child says, oh, I don't want to talk about it because I don't want to get anyone in trouble. And I suppose I'd put out there, without anything in this letter, if these kids have digital devices or screens, might they have seen something? Might one have shown somebody something and they don't want to tell on each other? It could be something like that. It could be that their interests have diverted. I would move away from trying to compel your daughter to tell you all of this, but I would leave the door open, so she, emotionally speaking, so that she knows that she can tell you. She doesn't have to. You're not forcing it, but she can. And sometimes that is about explicitly saying, look, I understand you don't want to talk about that now, but I just want you to know you can always talk to me. And if anything happened, or if you saw anything, or somebody sent something, you would not be in trouble for seeing something like that. That is something we could talk about and work our way through. But beyond that, I would just say, you're clearly upset by this. What can I do to help? And focus on just meeting her in the upset and helping her, because you're trying to strengthen that trust-based connection, because within that, she may decide to tell you what's happened. Now, Sean, she may not.
Yeah, yeah. And presumably then, there's another mother, another set of parents on the same street who have the same information, perhaps more or less, and maybe wondering, should they reach out to the person who wrote into us?
You're spot on. And because they're neighbours, like, normally I'd be saying, look, don't be going talking to other parents. If the girls can work it out, let them work it out. But these are neighbours as well. They're going to see each other all the time, whether these kids are talking to each other or not. And if they've gone from being great pals who hung out at home and school, of course, the other parents have noticed that that has changed. So this very much depends on the nature of your relationship with those other parents. But if you could keep it quite casual and say, do you have any idea what's going on? The girls seem to have fallen out. Have you heard anything from your end? I'm hearing nothing. I just want the two of them okay. If you can approach it in that way and maybe learn more about the story, but be aware that what you'll be learning is the other child's perspective and the other child's version or experience of this story. And it still isn't your daughter's story. That she can only tell you herself.
Yeah. Okay. Or, yeah. Does that run the risk of, well, I've heard nothing about this, I'm going to go home and I'm going to, you know.
Of course it does. Of course it does. Now, but the only thing is, they probably are aware the girls are not walking to school. That's quite an obvious thing. If they're not meeting up and walking to school, there'll be some notice about it. I think this, like I said, it very much depends on your relationship with those neighbours. If you've got the kind of relationship where you can say, heads up, has anything happened? Did you hear anything? Look, I didn't either. We'll both keep our ear to the ground and I'm sure they'll work their way through it. But also, I think, Sean, we have to respect when children tell us they are not friends with somebody anymore. We also have to accept that. And we have to say, okay, you know, that's a big decision. That must have been hard for you to decide that, and meet them where they're at, as opposed to, ah, now come on, I'm going to fix that friendship for you and get you back friends. Sometimes a friendship has run its course and we just need to accept that.
Yeah. And it's around the age where...
It is really. Yeah. It truly is. Yeah.
I'm trying to be mindful about, excuse me, about my kids' sugar intake, but I feel like I'm constantly battling the environment, school treats, birthday parties, play dates, even well-meaning relatives. During the Easter camp they are booked into and their regular sports activities, they will be given Easter eggs. Not even the small ones, but proper sized. Sugar doesn't seem to be taken seriously and I'm exhausted from having to intercept sweets all the time. How do I set boundaries around sugar without becoming the overprotective parent or offending family and friends? I can imagine the eye rolls, and I find this so hard, but it's important.
Well, that's the crux of it, isn't it? This is important to you, you know, to mind the eye rolls. People have little to be eye rolling about if they're eye rolling about you saying, I don't want my children eating all of this chocolate or whatever, or sugar, or whatever it might be. So, you know, I think sometimes, again, as parents, we kind of become apologetic for, oh, I don't want to offend anyone, but I really don't want this for my children. You're their parent. If you don't want this for them, then you have to set the boundaries with everybody else. And, you know, I do think, though, you know, when you're trying to intercept, I love that word in here. I'm exhausted from having to intercept sweets. I'm like, oh, God, like this is really putting you into police mode. And then that is because what you don't want to happen, and I think this is a risk, Sean, when we go into that mode of intercepting sweets, is our children might become secretive about them and they might kind of try to, you know, keep the sweets away from our attention so that we don't see them. And you don't want that at all, because we're just creating a kind of hierarchy on food. Food has a certain value, and good foods, bad foods, what I can eat, what I can't eat, all of that high emotional charge is, you know, it's a lot to deal with down the road. It creates a whole other set of problems, basically, is what I'm saying. The other thing, Sean, is like school treats, birthday parties, play dates, well-meaning relatives. I mean, how frequent is all that stuff? You know, birthday parties, I mean, depends on school, of course, and if they go to them all, that could be one a month or whatever, but it's not every day. So I always think when we're coming up to Easter, and this is such a timely question coming up to Easter, that It's one time a year that they get this chocolate. It doesn't have to be eaten at once. You can get very creative with, goodness, we've all this chocolate. Why don't we melt it down and bake with it and make crispy buns or whatever? And you can share them out amongst everyone. So the quantity of chocolate is actually being shared out. But you can, of course, talk about how all Easter eggs are family shared Easter eggs. So, you know, when you've got kids and they might get 7 or 8 Easter eggs each, that is a lot of chocolate for children who struggle with self-regulation, as many of us adults do around chocolate as well. But if you're saying, look, all the Easter eggs are family shared Easter eggs, you're going to mind them for the days that you, as a family, you say they can have a treat, or as I said, melt them into baking. In other words, you'll gradually get rid of them doing it that way. You can ask for no treats from relatives. I mean, your eye rolls aside, you can say, we're really, you know, trying to put a boundary on this. It doesn't suit our kids. It's not something we want to do. We're asking for no chocolate. We're asking for no treats. If there's something else, you know, we're asking for whatever you'd spend on an Easter egg, you know, that you just, we can buy them a collective book token or, you know, whatever, you know, just whatever you want to do with it. You just have to take a balanced overview to all of this, because overall, most of the eating is happening via this parent at home. This parent is very focused on this and keeping low sugar. So these kids are eating mostly well. most of the time. There are peak seasons and times of year when there's some intrusion from outside that you're not, as a parent, able to have complete control over, but you can just have with your kids. In our family, we have treat food, or whatever you want to call it, one day a week or at the weekend or whatever way. And so any treats that come into the house, we share them as a family. You can develop a little policy like that, but I would just encourage all of us to take a balanced view when it comes to Easter time.
Yeah, well, I think probably many people listening will have that experience. That, yeah. And it's not just what you buy yourself.
Oh,
you might
very,
buy them and then it's aunties, uncles, blah, blah. And everyone's offended if you asked them not to do that. And then sure, the eggs are hanging around the house for months afterwards.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I found one of those Easter bunnies in the house 6 months after Easter last year. I put it up somewhere and totally forgot. So I totally get it. I do relate to this. And I think, you know, you could say as family members, let's not buy the Easter eggs, you know, maybe get them some jellies, or let's make something or have a little outing as a family. If you had more of the family on board than you don't, Sean, that's a lot easier to do. But if you've got family going, oh, here she goes on her sugar buzz again, for God's sake, they're only kids, give them the chocolate, then you've got to manage it coming into the house. If you're not going to stop it coming in, manage it when it does come in.
Can you please ask Joanna, what's reasonable bedtime for a 12-year-old who gets up at 7:30 a.m.? It seems to vary wildly in my son's class, and it's causing ongoing rows. I'm not a mom who cares too much about what other pals or kids are allowed to do, for the most part, but there is such a variation, I'm starting to doubt myself. He currently goes to bed at 10.
I love this, because 12-year-olds, isn't that just peak pester power? You know,
yes.
They manage to get into your head and you're going, God, maybe I am unreasonable here. And suddenly you are comparing what other parents are doing with yourself. Don't get pulled into the, you know, but everyone else is type of chats. I would think for a 12-year-old, and I'd be really interested, Sean, in what listeners think about this, because I imagine there is quite a big variance on this. 10 o'clock feels quite late for a 12-year-old going to bed. Ideally, a 12-year-old would consistently get between 9 and 12 hours sleep each day. Now, that there is a variance, you know, of 3 hours there, 9 to 12 hours, and that variance really depends on their activity level and what best suits each child. Some of our kids just seem to run on fumes of air and they have endless energy. And some of our kids are exhausted by supper time and they're in need, even if they don't feel ready, they're in need of their beds. If he was to go to bed at 9 o'clock every night instead of 10, with the time he's getting up, that would get him 10 and a half hours sleep every night, which is slap bang in the middle of that recommended 9 to 12 hours. So I would be thinking 10 o'clock is a little late. It's putting you on the bare 9.5 hour side. If he's an active, busy 12-year-old, that extra hour sleep would make a huge difference. So just observe him. You know, how is he when you're calling him in the morning? Is he cranky? Is he still tired? Or does he wake adequately rested? Does he have enough energy to get through his day without huge effort? You know, he's comfortably able to do that. And when it comes to bedtime, be that 9 or 10 o'clock, is he ready for bed at that stage? So I would look at all those things. But if you're asking me, and they are, to make a recommendation, I would say 9 o'clock bedtime for a 12-year-old getting up at 7:30 and aim for that 10 and a half hour sleep.
Good luck with that then, folks. My wife is very keen to get our 5-year-old to do chores. I think it's a bit early. She wants her to put the bins out, empty the dishwasher, sweep the floor and other bits. She's pushing me to agree to a chore chart for the wall where we tick off our jobs once they've been completed. I feel very uneasy about this because I think she's too young, but also for another more selfish reason. I just know that her doing these chores will actually create more work for us. She will sweep dirt from one part of the floor to the other, and I can just see her spilling bin bags all over the floor. I wish my wife would hold off on chores for her until she's around 10. What are the guidelines around this?
Now, it'll come as no surprise to anybody that there are no set guidelines on this, but there's massive variance here. One of you wants them doing the hard knock life at 5 years old, and the other's like, oh, do nothing at all till 10. The biggest issue in this letter is get onto the same page, because before you present to any child that they're going to be doing chores and what's expected of them. They need to see this as a calm, clear, consistent message between both parents. Now, I'm all for chores. You know this, Sean, we've talked about this before, and I think you can start them doing chores in toddlerhood. However, it's a big however. If you have a two-year-old doing a chore and it is relevant to their lives, it's developmentally appropriate, like carrying their nappy over to the bin and putting it in the bin and closing up wherever the bin is. You know, at 5 years old, I think a child is capable of doing chores. I think it's arguably good for them. It gives them autonomy, independence, gives us something very tangible to praise effort over outcome every single day. But I'm thinking for a five-year-old along the lines of straightening their duvet when they get up, putting the pajamas under the pillow, carrying their laundry down to the laundry basket. I think clearing and setting the table as well within the developmental scope of a five-year-old. I just think the list that's included here, putting the bins out, sweeping the floor, that is a long list of chores for a five-year-old to do. So I think there are no set guidelines, but between the two of you, there is compromise and there is a middle ground, and you're both standing on opposite ends of that middle ground at the moment. I think sitting down as parents and talking it through, your wife clearly feels very strongly about this, perhaps grew up in a home where as children they were expected to help out. There is no harm in helping out. I think part of being in a family is that everybody should help out and contribute. But I think it has to be developmentally appropriate. I think most five-year-olds, it depends on the size of the bin bags, but the idea of them dragging the bins out, emptying a dishwasher, again, some five-year-olds, no problem, Sean. Some of them are going to be clattering those dishes around and you'll regret asking them. So picking things that you know she can comfortably master, that are well within the scope of her developmental task and goals, that's where I'd start. You can always, and we should, review and amend the chores our kids are doing as they grow and develop. I would start smaller and with a lower list, but both of these parents need to sit down and have a good chat about this.
Yeah, that is a long list. All right. My child has started saying she believes in God after hearing about religion from friends at school, particularly one close friend whose family is quite religious and who often talks to her about their beliefs. My partner and I are both atheists, and religion hasn't been part of our home life and is new territory for us. We don't want to dismiss her feelings or make her feel she can't explore ideas that interest her, but we're also unsure how to talk about faith when we don't share those beliefs ourselves. We want to encourage curiosity and respectful discussion without confusing her about where we stand. What's the best way for parents in our position to handle this?
It's interesting, isn't it? And I'm reading this, Sean, that these parents were raised atheist because religion hasn't been, they see it's a new territory. So it's not like they grew up with a particular religious family practice and as adults they don't practice and have decided to raise their family this way. If this is brand new, then I think that's where you start with her and say, you know, you're asking us questions or you're talking a lot about God and this particular religion. And, you know, we realize we don't know much about that. So let's go to the library together and get a book about religions. And there are some, I mean, there are, no surprise to anyone, there are lovely books out there that talk about all kinds of religions around the world and what they mean and give lots of insights. And you could talk about it with her quite holistically in that way, in a very inclusive way. I think Osborne do a lovely book about all the religions out there. But go to the library, pick up a few of them and have fun reading them together and go, oh, I didn't know this and I didn't know that. But also frame this that in your family, you don't practice religion. You don't have religious beliefs, and that's not something that you practice. But you're not saying she cannot do this, because either she's in a school, Sean, that is religious, which as we all know is most of our schools, or this little friend in school is talking a lot about religion. So I think getting to the bottom of that as well might be worth doing. So even having a chat with the teacher, is there a lot, are they doing a particular lesson in class? Is there a lot of talk about this? Is there something that you could be reading up on just so you can support her in understanding the information that's coming home? If it is just one little friend, I mean, again, it depends. That family wouldn't be that happy if your daughter was saying, no, I don't believe this. And my family say something, that you could have a chat and say, look, maybe we'll curtail the religious chat between them. I think that's very hard to enforce with children who are naturally curious, open to learning and love stories from each other. I would tend to go down the route of We don't practice as a family. We don't believe as a family, but you're curious about this and you're learning new information that I don't know a lot about. So together we're going to go and we're going to find out more so that we can understand religion, even if you're not practicing it. There's no harm in her understanding it, especially if she's going to be hearing it, as I said, either from school or somebody in school.
Few comments on some of the questions. This is about the bedtime for a 12-year-old. I'm a secondary teacher. I was taken aback when second years were asked if they take a nap after school. Easily 7 in 10 said they go for a sleep most days after school. Often their parents aren't at home from work to see this.
See, that would then feed into the later bedtimes because they've had a little cat nap during the day. Yeah.
Yeah, and on the question of sugar and Easter eggs, same scenario here. My son won a dancing competition in his creche last week, and the prize was a massive Easter egg. Rewards are always edible at his creche, despite making a sign forms about healthy eating. Drives me mad. It's the dancing that's the fault there, not the eating. Joanna, thanks a million as ever.
Sure. Moncrief, weekdays at 2. On News Talk, conversation that counts.